This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله والصلاة والسلام على رسول الله وعلى آله وصحبه أجمعين السلام عليكم ورحمة الله تعالى وبركاته everybody and I want to start by saying salam to my dear friend Suhaib Saeed. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So I wanted to have this session with you. You and I have been working on the Yusuf series together since its start, and we come across quite a few issues that I think are, it's good to take a break from the series and discuss. And yesterday I brought up to our audience that, there is a necessary conversation that Muslims that are engaged with the Quran should have about the early opinions of tafsir and what that, means. And then there are newer perspectives on tafsir. And sometimes one might feel like everything that had to be said about the Quran or the way that it had to be understood, that's already been done. There's no need to rethink or revisit. Or if there is, where do you draw the line? And we talked earlier about the two extremes, how one extreme says that there is no room for revisiting what's already been analyzed. And on the other, we can do away with what these people said in the past. We need to look at it all with fresh eyes and, kind of disregard what's been done in the past. So you and I spoke off camera, but I wanted to have this conversation on camera. And the difference is going to be you're going to tell me exactly what you've been telling me before. And for some of the terminologies that we'll come across, we'll try to break that down for everybody so that everybody's up to speed on this discussion and doesn't feel like something so specific for tafsir students and things like that. So you wanted to start off with tafsir bil-ma'thur and what was the bil-ra'i, right? So that's way too much Arabic, so let's break that up.
Maybe even before that, it occurred to me that it might be worth just saying something brief about what is tafsir and why do we need it? Like, why does it exist? Because I think that is a question that sometimes crosses our mind. After all, the Quran, as we understand, was revealed as a message and a communication. So there were people who were hearing the Quran as it was revealed, and it was in their language, first and foremost. So the Sahaba, and not only the Sahaba, but also all those around, so believers and unbelievers, not yet believers, supporters, opponents, they were all hearing the Quran and they were hearing it speak to them and about them, and they understood what it was saying.
Right.
So to a large extent, to a very large extent, there was understanding. And that means there wasn't much need for tafsir. We do have some narrations which point out to us and show us that on occasion, one or more people misunderstood something in the Quran or found it difficult to understand. So they came with a question to the Prophet ﷺ, or they expressed something and it showed that they misunderstood. So something had to be pointed out and corrected. So that's actually how I would say that we should see tafsir in general, that tafsir is actually about answering a question or about clarifying something where there is room for misconception, whether that misconception happened already or we just fear that somebody is going to misunderstand what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said. Now, why would someone misunderstand? We shouldn't think of that as being something to do with the Quran being unclear, but we should see that we ourselves can be unclear about the Quran. So
right.
I often like to look at it the way, we have so many courses, and I'm sure Bayina never did a course called this, but a lot of times this course is called Unlocking the Quran, right?
And yeah, so, I would never title a course like that.
I'm sure you would not ever have done that, but Unlocking the Quran, or sometimes they even say Decoding the Quran.
Yeah.
And it actually gets me a little bit annoyed because I just think to myself, well, in which ayah did Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala say that his Quran is locked? Or let alone to say that it is code, right?
Decoding, yeah.
So where are the locks? Well, we do have an ayah that talks about locks, but it's, do they not ponder on the Quran, or are there locks upon the hearts?
Right.
So the lock might be in our own self and not in the book itself.
Right.
So that's why tafsir is about taking you, taking me to the ayah which Allah has revealed, and taking away any gap, any lack of clarity, confusion, until we appreciate what exactly is being said.
Yeah.
And the reason that we need tafsir is to do with various things about ourselves. Now, if some of the Sahaba sometimes needed a clarification, and the Prophet ﷺ would sometimes explain to them directly. We only know that he did so about a few ayahs.
That's important because, I mean, in some of my courses, I ask the question to my students, what would be the obvious question would be the best teacher of the Quran is the Prophet himself, sallallahu alaihi wasallam. So it begs the question, how come he didn't interpret the entire Quran? I mean, we have only a sparing number of narrations that directly attribute an explanation or a clarification of an ayah to the Prophet himself, sallallahu alaihi wasallam. That here, innal quwwata ar-rami, for example, things like that, right? Those are very rare occasions. So the question I ask my students is, why is that? Why do you think that is? And in my head, there are a couple of answers to that. The first of them would be, if the Prophet ﷺ did interpret every ayah, then he would have a life longer than Nuh ﷺ, because the oceans of knowledge in the Quran coming from the wisdom of the Prophet ﷺ would still be continuing. Another is, if the Prophet ﷺ interpreted the Quran, we would have no room for contemplation left, because his is the final word. And there's nothing to be said. It's divine interpretation at that point too. It's the divine word and divine interpretation. And the Quran keeps forcing us to think and to contemplate and to reflect. And to even the Sahaba are sometimes engaged about a single ayah and having different points of view. And these are people in the presence of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. So those are at least my thoughts on the Prophet's own interpretation and why that's so rare.
Yeah. And with that, it's just to recognize that the Quran is speech. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has chosen the words by which he has chosen to speak to his Prophet and speak to us.
Yeah.
And when you do tafsir, so when any person, I mean any mufassir does tafsir, right? What they do, even if it's the Prophet ﷺ himself, or it's some of the Sahaba, or it's any mufassir after that in all the different centuries, what they do is they take, you know, those words and they give some other words to help you and me understand.
Right.
So in a sense, they offer another wording, another way of putting it. And let's suppose that they've done that in Arabic. Then you sort of feel like, okay, why are your words the words that I should pay attention to? Only because those words help me to understand the original words, the original speech. And then when someone is explaining into another language, like we're talking in English or whatever language you're explaining in, it's because the listeners don't understand Arabic or don't understand it enough to grasp everything straight away.
Yeah.
So you give them words in their own language. Then it's clearer. You don't feel so much that you're competing with the Arabic of the Quran when you're explaining in other languages, but you're just giving something that people can appreciate. So when we look at it that way, it's always about just seeing that the Quran is actually the priority has to be given to Allah's words and the way he worded things.
Right.
Everything else is there just for help, is there to clarify something. So yes, the Prophet ﷺ would sometimes explain to them. He would sometimes explain in words, but a lot of the time he would explain just by living, by applying the teachings of the Quran. So yeah. Sunnah, broadly conceived, is all of those things together, including those occasions when he specifically said something.
Words explain something in the Quran, but yeah.
Not necessarily every single thing that he explained, we necessarily have a hadith which was recorded and noted and preserved and reached us today. So there may well be other occasions when he did so. But it's broadly understood by the scholars that it's a minority of ayat of the Quran that the Prophet ﷺ actually gave a direct tafsir to, like a verbal spoken tafsir of.
Right.
Because he would have depended on the fact that his companions actually understood for the most part.
That's correct, yeah. And the other thing is, what you said, sometimes his interpretation or his explanation of the Quran isn't so verbal. A pretty easy example of that is the prayer, right? So the Prophet ﷺ demonstrating the prayer is pretty much the best tafsir of Aqim as-Salah in one way, right? So because the Quran is not highlighting its sequence and all of its components and, you know, all of its technicalities, that's only coming from the Prophet ﷺ's established example. So that's our starting point. And so, good, we had an intro conversation about the role of tafsir as being a helper to help us facilitate our understanding of Allah's words. Fine. Now we get to this big debate in, you know, scholarly circles, traditional circles, And not so much, maybe the average Muslim may not be as exposed to this, but the idea that the earliest generations have interpreted the Quran, the Sahaba, the first generation, second generation, and there are narrations about the, of the Prophet ﷺ talking about how they are the best of generations. Then the best of them are, the best generation is mine, then the ones that come after them and the ones that come after them. And what follows from that is, well, if they were the best generation, well, their understanding must have been the best understanding. And therefore, what has been recorded of the interpretation of the Quran in the earliest generations is the closest, if not the right opinion, the closest thing to the right opinion is that. But actually, I think most people think of it as that's the right, those are the right opinions, or those are the absolutely correct ways of looking at the Quran, because the Prophet ﷺ validated those generations by saying they're the best of all generations. And I wanted you to dig into how we may sometimes look at that statement and oversimplify it and what complications that creates.
Well, first of all, I mean, the most authoritative tafsir, I'm not going to say the typical thing. I mean, my PhD was actually about tafsir of the Quran through the Quran. So I'm a big fan of that approach. But I'm still not going to say that that is actually the most authoritative tafsir, because tafsir as a process requires somebody to have a question and then go about answering that. So whether they go to another ayah in the Quran to clarify it, or they find the answer in some other way, it's still a person who has to do tafsir. So then the Prophet ﷺ is actually the most authoritative mufassir, if we are going to use that word for him. He has, his explanations come from revelation, right? He does not speak of his own desire. In huwa illa wahyu yuha.
Right.
Only revelation which is inspired to him. So that applies when he is conveying the Quran, when he's explaining the Quran. First and foremost, it means his explanations are going to be authoritative. Allah Azza wa Jal has entrusted him with the conveying and the clarifying of his speech, of Allah's speech.
Yeah.
So in that regard, we have tafsir, which is wahi, which is actually revelation, and that has an ultimate authority. Then as soon as we go to the next stage, we're talking about the Sahaba. They were around the Prophet ﷺ, and their explanation, so when they are talking about the Quran, it is possible that when they talk about it, they are talking based on something they heard from the Prophet ﷺ. If they're doing that, then at that moment, they are also talking based on wahi, based on revelation.
Right.
Not their own direct, but indirectly, they're speaking based on revelation. In other situations, they may be basing it on their own knowledge. And their own knowledge is authoritative, but not in the same way and to the same level.
So we'll stop right there. So you've got the companions of the Prophet ﷺ are interpreting the Quran. And one possibility is if they present an opinion about some ayah, that it's something they learned from the Prophet himself, even if they don't say that. They don't say, I heard the Prophet explain this to me. They just forwarded an opinion, and we can assume one possible assumption is they learned that explanation from the Prophet himself, right?
Yeah, and that would be most, we would most think that when they're talking about something which no way that he would just make that up himself or have come from his own opinion. If he's talking about something that's going to happen on the Day of Judgment, the Sahabi is not going to be like...
He has no access to that knowledge.
So when they speak on that kind of topic, we have good reason to believe they're speaking about something they heard from the Prophet ﷺ. However, in some situations, that particular Sahabi we might know had a practice of discussing, for example, with the people of the book. And so it might open up other possibilities of where that particular explanation came from.
I heard this from his, old connections within the Jewish community or the Christian community or
converts who came into the Muslim community. But right. if we know about that Sahabi, that no, there's nothing really that indicates that he or she was mixing and discussing with others. So then that possibility, shrinks and becomes less likely about them. So yeah, it may well be they're speaking from based on revelation. And it may be otherwise that they are talking based on things that they witnessed. So, for example, some of the important information that we get from that generation is the context of revelation.
Right.
So we call it asbab al-nuzul. So you're saying the reason why a particular ayah came down or the thing that triggered it in a sense.
Yeah, the situation around the coming down of this ayah. And it can be that like a question was posed to the Prophet, and then an ayah comes, they ask you such and such, tell them such and such, right? So that's very clearly about that occasion. Or it could be that those ayat are a commentary on an event that just occurred. Mm-hmm. A woman came to the Prophet ﷺ arguing, and Allah reveals, Allah heard the one arguing with you about her spouse, something like that. So that's all asbabun nuzul, like what's the story behind this ayah, or when did it come? And it, sometimes it does answer why did this ayah come. Other times it's, in what context did it come?
Yeah, what was happening around that moment of revelation?
Right.
And sometimes when they tell you, nazalat al-ayah fi kada wa kada, when they say it was revealed in or concerning such and such,
right,
they don't always mean it, and the scholars have noted this, they don't always mean it literally that there was a specific moment and occasion, but they might be saying sometimes it was about that, or it relates to that, or it has a relation to that.
Or it can be applicable to that.
Or could be applicable to that.
Right.
So their way of talking about it is sometimes a little bit looser than how we might later want to pin it down on what they're saying. But the point is that they have a set of highly valuable perspective based on the fact that they were there when it all happened, right?
Right.
So they understand things in a way that people later on have no hope of having the type of insight that the Sahaba have. So their explanations are extremely valuable. Where they become especially authoritative is like the example that you gave. They have been praying with the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Nobody can compete with that level of closeness or that level of direct knowledge based on experience and practice.
How the prayer works and what are its components and what is its sequence.
We have some aspects of, which I mentioned, the Quran more so in the hadiths, and then this hadith have spread far and wide, and people gather the reports that they deem authentic. But that's so different from being there and actually having direct knowledge of it. So you can never dispense with the insights of that generation. And there will be certain topics where they were absolutely the best place to speak on it, and nobody can compete with them. Then there are other things which are a bit more open, right? So again, we're talking about situations where they're not speaking based on something they heard from the Prophet ﷺ, so it's not based on wahi, but where it's based on ra'i, where it's based on opinion, albeit we would say educated opinion, right? And there's such a difference between just, sometimes people talk about ra'i as if like people just guesswork or, no, we're saying the educated opinion, whether of the Sahaba or whether of later generations and scholars and mufassirin and commentators.
Yeah, so put a pause on that one for a moment. Let's break that down a little bit. So a lot of times people make this black and white line between tafsir bil-ma'thur and a tafsir bil-ra'i, which means tafsir that's coming from narrations, and by that they probably mostly likely assume either a hadith or a statement of a sahabi, an athar, or something from a tabi'i, this first generation, right? Those three generations, that's it, or those three groups or entities. And that's these are the tafsirs that are authentic, quote-unquote. That's the authentic tafsir of the ayah. And everything else that comes after is tafsir bil-ra'i, which means an interpretation of the Quran based on opinion. And then there's a narrative, well, we don't want to follow opinions, because opinions is like people who follow their whims, and the coin phrase is whims and desires, and they just want to follow this opinion or that. We want to follow the original, and therefore we want to follow tafsir bil-ma'thur, the first three generations and what they had to say. What you just said is a pretty big wrench in that view, because what you said is sometimes the Sahaba, in what they reported of their their understandings of an ayah, was itself sometimes an opinion, that it wasn't necessarily something taught from the Prophet himself. It was actually to the best of their understanding, that's what they got from the ayah.
Right, right. So this categorization where people talk about tafsir bil-ma'thur, tafsir bil-ra'i, has become very, very commonplace in the current day. And actually, it was some Azhari scholars who are to blame for this. Right? So they are some of the teachers of our teachers of our teachers have created this kind of division, which might be helpful to some extent, but can be quite confusing as well. Because all tafsirs, or I will say almost all tafsirs in our entire history are in reality a blend between these two things, right? So they're going to take narrations from the early generations, as you mentioned. This is what we'll call the ma'thur. Ma'thur just means transmitted, narrated, received, right?
Right.
And they're going to have the thought process of the mufassir involved. And I will give the example of Tafsir al-Tabari, because I heard sometimes people, even teachers, lecturers on Tafsir, who amazingly have described Tafsir al-Tabari as being purely narrations. It absolutely is not. You just have to pick it up, read through, and you'll see that it's absolutely not solely narrations. What happens is the narrations take a lot of space in the book, that's all. But for every ayah, Al-Imam al-Tabari, he is first of all going to give you some of his own insights and about some things about the words, what he sees as the right interpretation. And then he's going to say, ذِكْرُ مَنْ قَالَ ذَلِكَ, right? So I'm going to now give you some narrations about who said what I just said. And then he will maybe say to you, but there's an alternative opinion, which is such and such, and then he'll summarize it. And then, and here's the people who told you that. So that's why these narrations, with all their isnads and chains of narration, can take many, many pages. And you can miss, if you're not reading properly, you can miss the bit at the start.
And
at the end, where he says, and the best opinion out of all of these is the following, and for the following reasons. So that's him using his thought process as a mufassir. And every mufassir does that. Of course they should. I would go so far as to say, and I hope I don't create controversy by this, but you know what, the idea of tafsir bil ma'thur for me is not doing tafsir. You know, if all you're doing is transmitting, then you're a transmitter of tafsir. You're not a mufassir. A mufassir, if such a thing could exist now or in the future, is somebody who does use their thought process, deals with the materials, takes the materials, takes the transmitted opinions, narrated opinions, and makes sense of the various things. Because as you alluded to before, even amongst the Sahaba, sometimes there were different points of view about a particular word or particular ayah. There's a difference between a situation where they all agreed on something compared to where there's multiple points of view. And then, you know, it was very normal for the next generation to have more opinions, and the next generation to have more opinions. And over history, what tends to happen is more opinions get added to the list or to the pile of things that are said around the ayah.
Yeah.
And that is actually quite normal and not strange at all.
So on that not being strange at all, I'm theorizing, for instance, that a Sahabi, a prominent one like Ibn Abbas radiallahu ta'ala anhuma, for instance, has an interpretation of an ayah, and it's been narrated, attributed to him. And then you find names from the first generation also having opinions on the same ayah. And they diverge from the opinion of Ibn Abbas radiallahu ta'ala anhuma. So you find a prominent Sahabi known for Quran interpretation, having an opinion. And then the generation right after serving multiple alternative opinions on the same thing. In some cases coinciding, in other cases contradicting what the Sahabi said. So the idea that we don't disagree or we don't have another perspective from what the Sahaba offered, it seems to me, just from a cursory reading even of tafsir, doesn't seem to add up if you're actually committed to classical tafsir reading. Because that's also telling you that the idea of diverging views and people actually looking at things differently is one of the earliest traditions of the Quran. So now that that's, you know, we've sort of talked about that a little bit. What is, and if we're going to say a tafsir bil-ra'i is something, which is, let's translate that, interpreting the Quran by means of opinion. There is a dimension of that should be said, from my understanding, and I want you to add correct, from my understanding, there's a dimension of that should be criticized. And that dimension is when an opinion is forwarded about an ayah that is not rooted in, you know, some kind of academic rigorous thought process, meaning there's no basis for saying what you're saying about this word or this ayah in the language. There's no historical basis for it. There's no textual basis for it. There's no other ayah that supports it. Or the ayah that you're using to support it isn't about what you're using it for at all, etc. So you've got you've forwarded this opinion, but the basis of that opinion is very weak. So it's not so much that the opinion should be criticized. It's the basis on which one arrives at the opinion that should be criticized. And if at the end of the day, all we can do is have an opinion on what this ayah might mean and Allah knows best, then it is the process that should be what where we look most carefully, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why, to be honest, I'm not going to champion the name Tafsir bil-Ra'i as well. It's problematic. I mean, first of all, we have hadiths and various narrations from the Sahaba also, which said, that we should not speak about the Quran according to opinion. So once you're going to use the word ra'i, and then it's already been dispraised
by it's the hadith. Condemned.
But then what's happened in late works, like I said, these Azhari works, like Tafsir al-Mufassirun by Dr. Dhahabi, they started to talk about a Tafsir bil-Ra'i al-Mahmud versus Tafsir bil-Ra'i al-Mahmud.
So praiseworthy opinion, explanation.
And blameworthy. But the criterion for that is really, like, is the person from Ahlus Sunnah or not, right? Oh, so so that's why they would say Tafsir of al-Razi is praiseworthy opinion, and the Tafsir of Zamakhshari is blameworthy opinion. Even though in reality, all Tafsirs after Zamakhshari, including al-Razi's himself,
take from Zamakhshari.
And Zamakhshari was, he belonged to the Mu'tazili school of thought. Right. So the number of things in his Tafsir that are concerning and problematic, there's no doubt about it. But the idea of just sort of saying, well, let's call this praiseworthy opinion, let's call this blameworthy opinion. In reality, this whole thing of naming Tafsir as Ra'i versus Ma'thur, right? So opinion versus narrations is not that helpful, because in reality, all Tafsir has to be analytical. It has to be tradition-based, but it has to involve a certain level of new, fresh thought every time the Mufassir says about his or her work. It can't just be a case of, well, let me copy and paste what was said. You know, that's fine. You can copy and paste, but then that's
why do you exist? It's already been said.
That's who you are. You're a copy paster. That's fine. Like, we need people to do that, to transmit. But if you're going to be a Mufassir, if someone is going to decide to be a Mufassir one day, then it's going to involve learning the tools to actually understand the Quranic language, and to understand all these materials that surround the words of the Quran. So the fact that people could have different opinions is because they are all looking at the source, they're looking at the words of the Quran. Nobody else's words become sacred, with the exception, of course, of
That's where you hit it on the head. The issue to me is, in any inquiry, and the highest inquiry is inquiry into the sacred word of Allah, right? What is subject to criticism is not the person or even their conclusion. What should be subject to criticism is, what process did you engage in? What rationale do you have to arrive at that conclusion? And if you use the correct rationale to arrive at a certain conclusion, then what other leanings you have, or what background you come from, or what kind of training you have, all of that is pushed aside, because the thing to be criticized is the basis on which you're saying this. And can that basis be criticized? If somebody comes up with wild theories, and I mean, you've exposed me to some pretty wild theories about the Quran and things that have been said that I'm like, whoa, dude, there are people that...
things that get forwarded to me or sent to me, yeah.
Right. And okay, so it's not, oh, this person's not a real scholar, or this person's not from Ahlus Sunnah, or this person doesn't have a long enough beard, or this is not the basis on which I can criticize somebody's opinion. But what I can say, okay, well, this is just crazy, because I mean, obviously, look at the ayah, or look at the language, or look at this hadith, or look at this, and this is what I want to get at, really, and to at least from be transparent about my process, and in fact, I think yours also, is that we're committed to a rigorous process. Like, and if there's room for, a number of ways of looking at something, let's be honest about that. There's room. And sometimes there's no room for multiple ways of looking at something. Let's not pretend that there is. Let's be academically honest about where there is room and where there isn't room. And be open and transparent in why we feel it's this way or that way, right? And even at the end of the day, if I were to say, or you were to say, well, there's no other way of looking at this, and here's why. Even then, as students of Quran, we're going to say, well, that's the best of our understanding. If something comes along that shatters that point of view, we're ready to be shattered. And what I love about our process, even in the study of Surat Yusuf, is we'll look at different opinions. I'll posit to you that I think this is this seems to be more plausible, or this makes lesser sense. But what we do is, and that's what I want to get into now with you, laziness in tafsir, right? And we talked about different kinds of laziness in tafsir. Like, one kind of laziness is, I'm just gonna, whatever has been said, we don't have to think about it. That's what it says. That's what it means. And that's what this, look, Ibn Kathir rahimahullah already said this. Al-Qurtubi already mentions this. And Al-Tabari already mentions this. What more do you need? It's been figured out.
I mean, yeah, I think it is fair to describe that in a lot of cases as laziness. I would add one caveat, though. It's my fault for calling it laziness earlier in our conversation. But
yeah.
The caveat to that is, it is the way that a lot of our tradition actually functions. So what happens is that on many issues, a mufassir will just look to what has been said, and if he's satisfied that what they said is fine, then
see, that's the thing.
Look.
So I wouldn't dismiss them as just people of naql. They just transmitted. If they transmitted something and found it reasonable, they transmitted it.
Yeah, and the point is, there was no need to reconsider every single point.
Correct.
And an important example of this is anything to do with science, to do with the universe, cosmology, biology, geology, whatever it may be. So certain things were said at a time in the past, and that was based on the knowledge that people had about the world around them and beyond. And so, like, the way that the ayah was understood in the light of that was just, you know, was accepted and then continued to be accepted generation after generation.
Yeah,
we would make a mistake if what we do is we gather all these things. You can see behind me a lot of the books. If we open up each book and we say, well, this mufassir said it, and that mufassir also said it, and that mufassir also said it. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 20 mufassir, 50 mufassirs have said the same thing. There is ijma' on this matter. If we don't actually notice that what they were doing is repeating each other.
By the way, for those of you who don't know, ijma' means consensus. Everybody's agreed. So there's no room for disagreement on this, because 50 people have said it. 50 scholars have said it. Go on.
Right. So we just need to recognize that, okay, the reason for that might be that they were just repeating what each other said, because that was a sensible thing to do. And certain things, the case file was closed a long time ago, and there was no reason, no pressing need to reopen it, right? Later on, there might become a pressing reason for us to, okay, you know, dust off that file and say, you know, this point actually that we thought was not really worth investigating because it was straightforward. Turns out that based on our current understanding of the world, I know people get scared of the word science sometimes, but it just means, like, what we understand today leads us to think, hey, what if the ayah actually isn't saying what we just accepted that it said?
Right.
Let's look again. Let's take a
more could there be to it?
And I like to think of it as just reopening the case file. But people can get very nervous about that if they don't understand, well, the process by which that file was closed. It was maybe closed a bit hastily a long time ago, and then people just left it closed. And that's fine. You know, we don't blame them for leaving it like that. But we should be blameworthy if we think that doing tafsir in the 21st century involves just repeating what they said in the 14th century.
Yeah, yeah. So that's one kind of laziness. Yet another kind of laziness is, well, I think that people didn't have the kind of access to knowledge that we have now. We have new perspectives from the worlds of, you know, the hard material sciences, but also the human sciences like political science, sociology, anthropology, psychology, etc. You know, and as a result of that, we can have new perspectives on the Quran. And now that I have an opinion about this ayah, I can just, you know, whatever they said was probably based on very narrow-minded traditionalism. So let me not even defend their view. So what our process is, when we look at an interpretation of, you know, an earlier opinion that at first wasn't what we were thinking, that it was the direction it was going to go, instead of dismissing it, our job is also to kind of put ourselves in the interpreter's shoes, whoever they may be, and say, well, how can we defend this view? Before we disregard it, how can we defend this view that is even alien to us?
How do we read it as charitably as possible first?
Right. So
give it the best reading that we can do, like to appreciate what they're trying to say.
Yeah.
And then make the best version of that argument that they're making. And that's the example that you could say. I was just reading on, somebody was saying on Twitter today in Turkish. I was using the translate because I don't speak Turkish. But he was explaining that this is Imam Razi's approach. He would take, you know, things that were said by a Mu'tazili opponent, Qadi Abdul Jabbar, and he would say, he was going to refute him, but first he says, oh, let me to strengthen up his argument because he's expressed it a bit weakly. Let me actually bolster this up, you know, boost it up, and then I'm going to refute it. So that from a position of strength, that's what you do. If yeah. you are weak intellectually, then you try to pick the weakest version of the argument to dismiss it.
Dismiss it. That's right. You're not doing due diligence to these positions because you might just find that as you explore, not just somebody's opinion, like Sahaba, for example, had like sometimes two-word explanations or a one-liner or even a one-word sometimes explanation, which to me is like if you look at it, you know, as a diagram, it's a single dot and you can draw a line through a single dot in any angle, right? So you can look at it in a very critical way and dismiss it, or you can look at it from a point of view that maybe even makes you question, I think I can see where they're getting this, and it's a pretty strong way of looking at, you know, this ayah or this event. So,
and the numbers thing, I mean, so sometimes when you find that a number of great Mufassirin have said something, yeah. It doesn't mean it's necessarily true, but it does make you feel like, it's not something I can just sort of cast away without giving it a lot of thought. Like, yeah. or if I've got a new idea that's come to my mind, why didn't someone say that before? That's happened a few times in our process, like one or other of us has, you know, sometimes me as well, we come up with something. And we think, hey, this sounds really good, but why is it so obvious? Like, why didn't someone say it? Like, it's so strange. And then you realize later on, that's why it's got a fatal flaw in it.
Yeah.
You know, which you can get carried away sometimes with the excitement of new things. But that's the thing. We have a tradition. It has a weight. And yes, the consensus of time over time has weight. You know, it's not an immovable object.
So to summarize where we are in this discussion, one kind of laziness is that we don't give it a deep enough look and look at it, you know, with a fresh, looking at tradition, but looking at tradition with a fresh set of eyes. Right? And the other is that we are, you know, one, we just accept it for what it is. And two, we dismiss it without actually giving it its due diligence. And we can't do either one. We can't just accept it at face value. We have to analyze it. And it may be sometimes that we end up disagreeing with a very well-established opinion. We may have to justify ourselves. And then actually the onus of justifying ourselves for why not being as convinced of such a classical opinion falls on us. We better provide a really strong rationale for not agreeing or not being as convinced with opinion A. But even if we do that, I don't think it's okay for us to say, well, they're wrong. The furthest I can go is I find this more convincing. That's pretty much as far as I can take it. But they're wrong and, you know, we got it right or somebody else got it right. I think that's where things become very authoritative and we start laying claim to the right version. And that shouldn't exist in most Quran study.
And that's where there's, we could call it a third type of laziness. We've sort of touched on it, but it's when you come up with your own opinion. Like sometimes I've read this so many times where people will say, well, the other opinion, the one that I'm disagreeing with, has got so many problems in it. 1, 2, 3, 4. And I'll list all the problems of it. And then with my own opinion, I don't spend any energy in the problems in it.
Yeah.
Because in reality, it's just, I'm afraid life is not as simple as that, you know, as they say, black and white, where, you know, all the truth is on one side and all the falsehood is on the other side. And as soon as you decide which side is true, the other one must be batil, 100% falsehood and lies, right? In reality, there's always going to be this sort of negotiation between this is stronger, this is weaker, but there's always going to be pros and cons for both sides. So you've got to know that, okay, even if this is the opinion that I actually side with, it does have a couple of holes in it, but I think those holes are not so damaging that the boat is going to sink. I still think it has legs. I'm going to mix the metaphors, but I side with the
legs. Yeah, you mixed it.
Both with legs. So I side with this opinion, but But I acknowledge that it has some aspects of weakness, which perhaps someone else can solve. You know, the next person could maybe solve the problems, in my opinion, and make it even stronger. But if I just sort of pretend that, I've cracked it, you know, I've cracked the code, and, you know, it sort of makes me annoyed at the person. So it's another aspect of selling short our tradition, actually. And it misrepresents things to our readers or our listeners. You know, in order to bolster your own position, you sort of just tear down other things, especially tearing down your tradition, because if it weren't for our tradition and the scholars who went,
we're having any of these conversations.
We don't have anything.
We have nothing.
No understanding whatsoever.
Like any knowledge, you know, any science, whether it's architecture, medicine, tafsir studies, it doesn't matter if it's a secular science or a sacred one. It's built upon the intellectual foundations of the generation that came before. They got to a certain place, and only by understanding where they got to can you take a single step forward. And that single step forward doesn't dismiss the mountain that they built or that building that they built. It only takes a step because that building exists, right? So it's you have to have that monumental respect for the intellectual tradition that we have to build on top of that and to look at that with a degree of reverence. And, you know, one of our favorite tafasir is Ibn Ashur, may Allah protect and preserve him, and Alusi, and both of these remarkable, traditional in their style, and yet, yeah. and yet so rigorous when they critique something, right? It's such a beautiful thing to read, the amount of rigor and work they put into, you know, presenting an opinion. And sometimes it's pretty cool when you say, okay, let's see what, if we can find some Hurriya or something and read Ibn Ashur. And you say, hey, he didn't put as much work into this one. And you're so disappointed because when he puts into it, he really gets into it. Rahimahullah, right? Or even Alusi rahimahullah. And people like that are go-tos for us because they've really blazed a path when it comes to rigor, you know, like really deep analytical thinking about the Quran and looking at what we have in the past.
And the other thing that happens sometimes is that, you know, we get this really fancy opinion that we think is so cool. And then I'll be like, oh, hold on, I just found it in Alusi. He says exactly what we're saying. And then I'll read through the paragraph. And then at the end, he says, well, laysa bishay.
That's nothing. That ain't nothing. Just like that ain't a thing. He'll say, hey, that's the best thing about Alusi. He'll describe an opinion as if it's his. And at the end of it, and by the way, all that, nah.
it really puts you in your place, one of the most formative things for me has been reading in, and I'm still reading it. You know, there's a lot to get through, but the tafsir of Alusi, just as an example, because it's so critical. I mean, in a sense, it deals critically with the materials, rational perspective, from hadith perspective, everything is all there. You appreciate that, you know, what it takes to be a mufassir, you know. On that level, it's just, you know, it's mind-blowing.
Yeah.
And it just puts you in your place. You know, we're people who are doing some readings and we're trying to say a few things and we're trying to clarify some things. We're sharing thoughts. And those thoughts are based on our tradition, based on what we read. But first and foremost is trying to clarify what Allah Azza wa Jalla said insofar as we have questions, you know. And I started the remarks about tafsir by saying tafsir is the answer to questions. You know, you have to have that curiosity. You have to have questions that come to your mind. When you read the Quran, you know, then each one of us might have questions, and we might not know how to research them, but we can at least note them down, because then we get a chance to maybe talk with the scholar.
On the head, because tafsir is at the end of the day the answer to our inquiry. And our query into Allah's word and how He may answer what we're experiencing. And because of that, because the world is experiencing different things in every generation, in every society, people are going to come to the Quran with different kinds of questions. And therefore, they might be, when you're looking for a certain thing, that someone who came before you wasn't looking for that. So when they gave their answers, meaning their tafsir, you didn't find them talking about that because they didn't ask the question you were asking. That doesn't mean you don't have the right to ask that question. It also doesn't mean that what they said is irrelevant because you're not appreciating that they were asking a different question. Their answer is actually highly relevant for the question they were asking. But there are other questions that we may be asking now, right? So, and that is really
that doesn't always belong. That doesn't always belong in the genre of tafsir, right? So, tafsir sometimes is limited by the fact that there are certain norms of what is actually going to be discussed in books of tafsir.
Right.
In modern times, I think people writing about the Quran have sometimes expanded their mode of what they're looking at and what they see as worth writing in the books. But the early scholars weren't writing most of the time about, you know, spiritual angle and so on. Some of them did, but a lot of tafsir comes across as very dry, very based on analyzing language, hyper-analyzing things.
Hyper-grammatical analysis,
It's just because that's what the format was, right? It's different maybe what they would have done in their circles, with their families, like what you see later on, Sheikh Sha'rawi, rahimahullah, just because I was talking negatively about Azhar before. Sheikh Sha'rawi is one of us, and we are one of him, inshallah. Sha'rawi, you know, a very famous Egyptian scholar, preacher, you know, he showed how to talk about the Quran in a way that people's hearts were just, you know, absolutely fell in love with.
Yeah.
So that's not the typical thing that you find in the books, because books are books, you know.
They're not meant for a spiritual insight. And they all drop some here and there, and you'll go, whoa, but a lot of times it is very rigorous academic discourse. And it is, you're right, it can be very dry. Lastly, what I wanted to, you know, touch upon and hear your perspective on is new opinions in tafsir. And, you know, now because we are looking at things from a different lens, perhaps, and just let's be more specific so we don't talk entirely in theory. In studying Surat Yusuf and going through the classical works and the tafsir and the language, I've brought up questions to our conversation that have to do with the psychology of the situation, that have to do with the economics or the politics of the situation, and, you know, what may be generalized and things like that, things that we didn't really read classically. But it's certainly questions that come to my mind, and I pose them to you, and we start theorizing about what plausible response the Quran may be giving, or what we may find in our tradition that can substantiate or invalidate the direction we're heading in, right? But I feel, my opinion is that this is a very important development in our engagement with the Quran, that we should be asking questions and we should be concerned with thorough responses to those questions, not just quick fix responses, but really let's ask a deep question. And if we don't find an answer, we should be able to say, yeah, I don't have the answer for that one. The question remains, right? Like Imam Razi said, وَفِيهِ مَسَائِلِ, right? So and it may be that we end up with questions that we don't have answers to, but I think the process of asking all kinds of questions, you know, for the purpose of really benefiting from what Allah is saying. At the end of the day, what is it? How is this relevant to my life? How is it going to benefit me? Why is this a reminder for all of humanity? That's the fundamental, right? And that's the thing in tafsir studies, one can get lost in the contest of opinions and lose sight of the fact that this is actually a conversation between Allah and every human being on earth, you know? And we have to sometimes when you go too far in brain work, you have to come back to that basic truth. That's something I wanted to ask you or talk to you about. Where do you see because you're seeing a lot of different new trends in Quran studies. We won't even call it tafsir studies, now Quranic studies in the West and in the Muslim world. And what are some exciting areas of inquiry that are now emerging that you think are going to help us see the Quran, you know, in add a new but substantial perspective to the Quran without removing the old? So what are some of those in your opinion?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because like tafsir as a process and as a science is actually a few different sciences that all come to play together. So some things that have been very important is understanding the language, so that codifying what the Arabs meant when they use certain words, right? And then how certain structures work. So that's where grammar studies comes in. And then beyond that, the way that expressions are used to carry meanings and convey them effectively, this is where you get balagha and rhetoric. And all of these sciences were actually codified after the revelation of the Quran in service of the Quran. So tafsir as a kind of catch-all genre that deals with these things, plus, you know, hadith and plus, you know, other, you know, belief and fiqh and usul fiqh and different branches of knowledge which come to bear in understanding the Quran. They were actually formulated by scholars in service of the Quran in order to help us to understand what the Quran is saying. So in reality, there's no reason that there should only be this particular number of sciences that are relevant. Hmm. But there may be things that continue to develop, that have their seeds in the early stage, but that maybe bear fruit later on. So an example of, you know, there's examples of things that we actually do set about using where we can, and they're still somewhat in the exploratory stage and developmental stage. One of those is structural approaches, right? So recognizing that the asura as a unit can have, you know, I feel funny talking about this instead of you talking about it, but the idea that asura has a structure, you know, at the very least, beginning, middle, and end, but then more subtle aspects, right? Yeah. Where things can appear once you read it very carefully. And that's what I like to point out, that people sometimes think that when you're giving your talks and you talk about, okay, there seems to be a sort of a ring structure in this place, or like a double ring, or you come up with. People sometimes just think, okay, that's just for, like, almost for fun, like, wow, that's really exciting, like, it's beautiful. But in actual fact, you can then use that to further understand the way that the message is being delivered, and it might deliver new insights about individual ayat, you know, according to their placement. And you know, people should watch, you know, the lectures you've done, especially the Juz Amma ones, the new ones, not like the old school podcast things, but like the new ones.
Yeah.
Where I think that has started to really bear fruit. So the structural aspect, or what you can call, related to that, a kind of what's often called the coherence reading. Right. But I like to see it more as, like, it's where you're reading between the lines. You're really thinking about, okay, this ayah is followed by this ayah is followed by this ayah. What is going on with this sequence? Why are they next to each other?
Again, generating. Yep, that's right.
Yeah, things, you know, go back. Again, the Mufassirin had something called munasabat, or connections.
Right.
How appropriate, you know, the placement of ayahs is. You've got particular mufassirs that were really interested in that, like Al-Biqa'i. The point is, it's a valid approach. It's a type of reading, a way of reading the ayahs, which then generates insights which help to understand in tafsir. And the third one, maybe the last one I would draw attention to, is the intertextual approach, that is to read the Quran in tandem with other things that we can have access to.
Right.
The fact is that we know that the Quran was revealed to an audience that included Jews and Christians and various other religious groups, and would speak to them about things that they were supposed to know, and the Quran would call them to witness for that. Don't you know about this? Don't you know about that? And it would tell them about.
Well, if it says "don't you know," that means it's referring to what they have. And it's using that as a basis to initiate that conversation with them. And so now we're in a position to engage in a study of what they did, in fact, know, and what scholarship surrounds the biblical tradition, for example, and how the Quran is commenting on it, right? What do they call the Quran in the biblical subtext?
Right? Yes, yeah, so there's a famous book in the field. So this is actually very, very hot right now in Western academia. But of course, in the past, it was more tilted towards just identifying how the Quran has taken and borrowed and mixed different things from biblical sources.
That's what the Western approach was, yeah, to show that it's Quran is just plagiarism at the end of the day, yeah.
Now the way of talking about it has shifted quite a lot. So there's much more emphasis on recognizing that the Quran, you know, as we know, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is the one who it's his speech, but, you know, speaking in the sort of neutral academic way, they would say the Quran, or the author of the Quran, has actually exhibited a lot of creativity in responding subtly and in in very ingenious ways and turning.
Retelling the biblical account.
In retelling, and so biblical and also from other sources.
Other sources, right? Yeah.
Now, from our perspective, we could go further than that and say, and I think that you were hinting at it just before, that being the speech of God, it had its effect at the time of revelation. So we can look at that historically and say, okay, how was it responding to them then? How was it speaking to them then? Yeah. So we can understand something. But then also we can say, well, being the speech of God, which is intended as guidance for all times, what does that tell us about the guidance today? What is the message that we can then extract that is should be part of the dialogue and be the basis, actually, of the dialogue that we're having with people of other faiths today? So that's where I think we would diverge from, you know, like the secular academic approach or, you know, the outsider approach to it.
Because the other thing, we're not doing tafsir of the Quran using these sources, but actually, and we shouldn't be so, we shouldn't be thinking about this from a weak perspective. The Quran is the mighty word of Allah, right? And it's called Nur, it's called light. So it sheds light on all things. And it may even shed light on how we read the Bible and what we understand of it, because now the Quran is shedding light on something in its own way. And that's something that's manifested in our discussions ongoing with the comparative study of Yusuf in the, you know, in the Quran and the Joseph account in the Old Testament, on how there are so many divergences and so many differences, and how it just makes you appreciate the Quran story anew. The Quran's version of it, just anew. And it's not necessarily to criticize the biblical version. In some cases it is, I'll be honest. But in many cases it's also, wow, Allah Azza wa Jal really did turn it into Ahsan al-Qasas, you know? And it just, it highlights that. And I think it's a really beautiful direction to take. The place that I first experienced this, that just absolutely fascinated me, was Ashabul Kahf. One of the first in-depth surahs I did work on. And the old account of the sleepers and the, you know, the Jacobite church and the, you know, the murals and the tradition that existed in this among the Syriac tradition and the Aramaic versions of this thing and the Greek versions of this story that were already circulating, that were not, of course, this is not in the Bible, the story of the people of the cave, but it was very popular among Christian Arabs, and it was they were turned into seven saints. And they had festivals around it and all of this stuff. And not knowing that background, we come to the Quran, we learn about seven remarkable or a number of remarkable young men that held on to their faith. But when you study that stuff and you realize how Allah is setting the record straight about these anonymous young men, and their story has been hijacked and Allah is reclaiming it, it's amazing.
Yeah. Honestly, I think it was before I joined Bayina, I watched that first, you know, the really? First of your series in Al-Kahf, and absolutely mind blowing. I saw that lecture to people all the time. The first one, and that's on YouTube, so people can find it easily.
Yeah,
Al-Kahf series. You know, it's really worth watching because it just really whets your appetite for what this approach can bring to light. Now, that doesn't mean that every person has to know this, or that it's fundamental to Quranic guidance. It's just another aspect of how we can appreciate the meanings and the guidance of the Quran, and that's really the goal of everything, right? It's also not just to say, wow, the Quran is amazing, because, you know, alhamdulillah, we already believe in it. We don't need to be more convinced. It doesn't hurt, you know, to have some more strength to that.
You know what? I don't agree. I see the Quran's role serving our guidance, the purpose of the Quran being our guidance, is one the fundamental dimension. But if you think of guidance as a large umbrella, part of guidance is being inspired. And being inspired means being in awe of the word of Allah. And this kind of an exercise renews that awe, which then recommits you to guidance. So guidance isn't just pray and remember Allah and do dhikr and those things. Yes, those things are the do's and the don'ts, but our emotional connection, our intellectual connection to this book, that gets renewed by these kinds of studies. Our sense of identity, you know, our sense of ummah, you know, all of those things need refresher. They need to be renewed. You know, those things can easily, a sense of identity can easily start becoming weak. And so, which is why any of those, like even the wow, the Quran is awesome thing, I think is so important now, because there's so many other things to say wow to. And the Quran needs to crush all of that, or we need to show how the Quran crushes all of that, and it's the biggest wow of all, right? Mm. And that's our job, because if not, then we're not going to find, we won't even find Muslims saying that this is something remarkable. I mean, the jinns are hearing it and saying Quran and ajaba, right? But Muslim teenagers aren't saying it. They're like, Quran, meh. No, let's bring back the wow. You know?
Yeah, I accept that. So I think that really it's about it's dusting off ourselves, right? Is what is it that's preventing us from seeing that? That's where the emphasis goes, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's not that you always have to come up with something new, right? Because sometimes there's a temptation to always be novel, because we've got to, our content has also always got to be controversial. We've always got to have something new to say. It's really about just doing it in the best way that reaches people and helps them to appreciate things on every level that we can have the honor of helping them with.
That's right. And some of the most beautiful things I've ever learned about the Quran are from the older sources and what's been said about it. And some of the most profound insights. It's just that even their insights at that time, if somebody wrote about the Quran 800 years ago and I'm reading it now, what I gain from that now is different. So it's their words have a new flavor now. It's the same seed, but the tree's born new fruit, you know? So there's a renewal even in going back to tradition. It's not stagnant when you read it. It actually has new application. So just like the Quran has a level of new application, our reading of tafsir also has a new application. We can build on it and actually really take from it. I'm really glad we had this conversation, and I hope that you guys listening in. The monitor's too far for me to read comments, and maybe that's a good thing. But hopefully we'll get some interesting questions out of this, and maybe we'll have a follow-up session to address some of them, inshallah. But I'm hoping that this also becomes a continuous thing for us. Every time some sort of issue that helps us really think about the Quran in a deeper way comes up, that you and I just get on the camera and have a little chat about it. So with that, inshallah, I'll conclude. If you have any concluding thoughts, I'd love to hear them. Otherwise, goodbye. You good? All right. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.